Becky J. Pree. Ms. Johnson.
Thank you very much, Judge. My name is Jenny Johnson, and I've been appointed to represent Betty J. Pree in this case. Ms. Pree was convicted of filing false income tax returns for 1995 and 1996 in violation of 26 U.S.C. Section 72061. To convict a defendant under Section 72061, the jury must find both that the tax return filed by the defendant was false in a material manner and that the defendant signed the return willfully and knowing it to be false. The material falsity charged in the indictment in this case was that Pree received more income than she reported on line 22 of her return. Line 22 is a total of lines 7 through 21 above it. The government in this case has utterly failed to prove that line 22 on Pree's return was actually incorrect. The vast majority of the evidence and argument at trial centered on sales of stock, which, according to the government, should have been reported as capital gains on line 13 and totaled into line 22. At trial, the government presented evidence that Pree sold shares of stock. The government did not, however, present any reliable evidence that Pree had a capital gain that resulted in reportable income. Rather, at every stage of the trial, the jury was led to believe that the amount of Pree's stock sales automatically constituted income that she should have reported on her returns. That simply is not true as a matter of law. A sale of stock only results in capital gain if the amount realized in the sale is higher than the taxpayer's basis in the stock. By allowing the government to equate the amount of stock sales with capital gains, the trial court committed three critical errors at Pree's trial. First, the court allowed a revenue agent from the IRS to testify that the amount of Pree's stock sales should have been included in her income, even though that conclusion was necessarily based on his own unsupported opinion that Pree's basis in the stock was zero, simply because he couldn't walk into Merrill Lynch and sell it. Second, the court failed to instruct the jury on the law with respect to computation of capital gains and determination of basis, which prevented the jury from evaluating an essential element of the government's case.
You didn't object to that testimony coming in, nor were instructions tendered by the defendant in that regard, were they?
Instructions were not tendered, and the defense counsel at trial did not object, which is why we've asked the court to review this under the plain error standard of review. The final error at Pree's trial...
Of course, that means whether your error is plain or not, right?
Yes, and we believe that our error is, in fact, plain because it's clear under current law that a capital gain does not occur unless the sale resulted in more income or more money for the taxpayer than the basis they had in the stock, and that it affects her fundamental right to have a jury consider every element of the case on which she's being tried. So we believe that it truly is a plain and reversible error.
The government's assertion that there was income isn't sufficient?
No, the government cannot just assert that there was income unless they
prove
that.
Well, there would have to be some basis, but I mean, you believe there's no basis for any sale to show any income?
Without having proven what Pree's basis was, or at least the minimal proof that her basis was actually less than the amount of the sales, then no, there's no evidence in this case that Pree had capital gain income that she did not report. The third error at Pree's trial was that the judge denied Pree's motion for judgment of acquittal in spite of the fact that the government introduced no reliable evidence that Pree had unreported capital gains and no evidence that line 22 of her return was actually wrong. These errors at trial absolutely denied Pree her fundamental right to a fair trial. I'd like to start with the issue of the improper testimony by the agent in this case. Revenue Agent Welch testified that the amount of Pree's stock sales should have been included in her total income and that her basis in the stock was zero. That was well beyond the parameters of what a summary witness is allowed to do. A summary witness may summarize the testimony that's already been in evidence or the exhibits that are in evidence. A summary witness cannot go beyond that to to offer expert opinion. Mr. Welch was not qualified as an expert witness. He wasn't disclosed as an expert witness. And if you review his qualifications, you'll see that he testified to a fact that is wholly outside of his realm of expertise.
The defense made no contemporaneous objection to his qualifications or to his testifying as an expert?
The defense did not object at trial to his testifying as an expert, but he wasn't proffered by the government as an expert at trial.
I understand.
So no, there is no contemporaneous objection, and it is plain error review.
He was cross-examined, was he not, by the defense?
He was indeed.
I see.
But the fact that the defense at trial brought out some of the weaknesses in his testimony does not alter the fact that it was error for the court to allow him to testify that Ms. Free's basis was zero. The court itself has a duty to allow only reliable evidence to come before the jury. Under Daubert, that's the court's responsibility to make sure that any expert testimony that is given before the jury is in fact reliable and based on, given by a person who's qualified to make those.
Judge, could I ask that you speak a little louder so the counsel can hear you?
I believe that it came in, and it would have to be considered nothing other than opinion testimony. I did, Your Honor, because it wasn't summary testimony, so for Mr. Welch to have offered these opinions, it must have been, I think we could evaluate it under the appropriate standards for whether it should have qualified as expert testimony or not. I don't think there was any argument that he was a lay opinion witness, so I think that it would have to be evaluated under the appropriate standards for an expert, which are, of course, enunciated in Daubert versus Merrill Dow, which requires that the expert actually be qualified in the area in which he's testifying and rely on reliable methods that are generally accepted within the community of those types of experts. Saying that you can't sell stock by walking the Merrill Lynch just isn't a reliable method of valuing restricted stock. And moreover, and probably more importantly, the sheer assumption that simply because stock is restricted, it has a market value of zero, is wrong as a matter of law. The Eighth Circuit has found that in ARC Realty, and a number of cases in the tax court go to great depth to figure out what the fair market value of restricted stock is in any particular circumstance. Welch's off-the-cuff comment that it must be zero simply is not reliable enough for the court to have allowed it into evidence in this case.
Well, your theory, though, is that in effect, the judge should take over the responsibility, total responsibility, for seeing which witness should testify and which would not with withstanding, nobody's objecting to it.
I believe that under Supreme Court precedent, yes, the judge does have some responsibility to allow or to not allow unreliable testimony from an expert to go before the jury, whether or not it's objected to at trial. And a different panel of this court has found that exact same thing in Freimer Brunati versus KPMG, where an accountant was allowed to testify to valuation of certain investments that were made. And the accountant said, you know, these investments were worthless. A panel of this court actually set aside the jury verdict after saying that, no, in fact, that wasn't reliable expert testimony. It wasn't objected to at trial. Well, actually, I would have to check that. I don't want to misrepresent that to the court. I'll have to check that and see. But the court found that that was so unreliable that it was worth setting aside the verdict. So I think that the judge does have some responsibility to make sure that only reliable evidence goes to the jury.
Ms. Johnson, how about the gambling earnings? Why aren't the gambling earnings in and of themselves sufficient to support the conviction?
There are several reasons for that. The first is that line 22 is a total of lines 7 through 21. Ms. Pree admits that there was some gambling income that she did not report. She doesn't admit that that was willful, and that goes to some of our other arguments. But that would gambling income, I believe, would have been reported on line 21. We don't know if line 22 was actually incorrect unless we know if Pree had a capital gain or a loss. It is entirely possible that a capital loss that she would have reported on line 13 would have offset the unreported gambling income on line 21 and resulted in line 22 being true and accurate. And as this court found in the Reynolds case, literal truth is a defense under 72061. The government actually does have to prove that line 22, which is what it charged in the indictment, is incorrect. And by having two factors that get totaled into line 22 that are allegedly incorrect, the government in this case has to prove that line 13 actually was not an offset to the unreported income in line 21. The other reason that the gambling income isn't sufficient to convict Ms. Pree is that there's absolutely no evidence in the record that Ms. Pree willfully had unreported gambling income. The government's argument on that is that Ms. Pree reported some income in 96 and didn't report any gambling income in 95. Strangely enough, the exact amount to the dollar that the government claims should have been reported in 95 was in fact reported in 96. The W-2Gs for 96 do not add up to that dollar amount. And Ms. Pree had both her 95 and 96 tax returns prepared at the same time by the same third-party preparer. The only rational conclusion to draw from the fact that the exact amount that should have been reported for 95 was reported for 96 is that that tax preparer made an inadvertent error and Ms. Pree failed to catch it. As we all know, inadvertent errors do not subject someone to criminal liability under the tax statute.
Was that theory argued to the jury?
Which theory? I'm sorry, Judge.
That it was an inadvertent error.
Yes.
There was
no argument to the jury that it was willful.
Was that offered as a possible explanation?
By the defense that it was inadvertent?
Yes, that it was inadvertent error.
I believe so. I'll have to look at the gambling income in particular. It was definitely argued to the jury repeatedly that Ms. Pree believed her return was correct, and if in any way, shape, or form it wasn't correct, it was a mistake and it was an inadvertent error. There was such a minor emphasis on gambling income at trial that that argument may not have been made, in particular with respect to the gambling income. Gambling income at trial was submitted solely through a stipulation and took up, I think it's a total of 5 lines of the government's 30-page closing. So nobody at trial was focused on gambling income. Everybody was focused on stock sales, which leads me to the third reason why it would be inappropriate to uphold. I'm sorry, I didn't understand, Judge. The government was focusing on, they had 3 counts of the indictment that they were attempting to prove, and for 95 and 96, yes, it was false filing, and the indictment, of course, charged the falsity as being line 22. The vast majority of the evidence was that the government was trying to show that line 22 was wrong because it didn't include stock sales. They also threw in that line 22 was wrong because of the gambling income. What they utterly failed to prove is that Pree didn't have a capital loss that offset the gambling income and resulted in line 22. Tax deficiency is not an element of false filing, and we have never argued that it is. Actual falsity, however, is an element of a violation of 72061. And I don't believe I understand your question. I think that the evidence in the record was that she admitted to a government agent, this is from the government agent's perspective and that person's testimony, and I'm giving you that because I do understand that in a sufficiency of the evidence argument, you draw all inferences in favor of the government, was that Pree said that she understood that she had to report stock sales in the year in which they occurred. May I finish answering the question?
Of course.
That understanding is not the same as understanding that she had a capital gain in 95 and 96. It's essential to know that if she had, Ms. Pree testified at trial that her understanding was that she had a loss and actually had money coming to her because she was selling the stock for less than the amount at which it was trading in the marketplace. Simply understanding that she knew she had to report stock in the year it was sold does not mean that she knew she had a capital gain that would have resulted in additional taxable income to be included in line 22 of her return. She very well may have understood that she would lose the deduction or lose the credit if she didn't report those stock sales in the year in which they occurred. But there's been no evidence anywhere that she understood she had a gain that she didn't report. So there's no evidence that line 22 is actually wrong or that Ms. Pree understood it to be wrong.
Thank you, Ms. Johnson.
Thank you very much.
Ms. Johnson, just so that you can plan, although your time had run, I plan to give you 2 minutes for rebuttal. And Mr. King, I'm going to enlarge your time by 2 minutes as well.
Thank you very much.
We'll hear now from Mr. King.
Good morning, Your Honor. My name is Patrick King. I'm appearing on behalf of the United States, and I'm appearing here asking you to affirm the conviction in the district court. First, looking at this in the light most favorable to the government, there is sufficient evidence that a rational jury could find the essential elements of the crime beyond a reasonable doubt. It was false. The defendant's returns for 95 and 96 were false as to a material matter that she did not believe was true and correct, and the gambling income alone sustains that. The government argued this to the jury, I believe it's at page 19 of the sentencing transcript, specifically that the defendant's failure to include her gambling income alone made her 95 and 96 return false.
Well, let's turn to the other, and how do we know that she had a gain in that? Why do we know what the basis was to determine what any income?
Without considering gambling income?
Yes,
or
yes, just focusing on the stock sales.
Focusing on the stock sales, we know the defendant had a gain, if by nothing else, by her own admission. The defendant's story at trial was she filed a 1994 tax return under very unusual circumstances. She applied for an extension, but well before the extension ran, she didn't know how long the extension was. She broke tradition of going to a paid preparer, sought out a volunteer at an Internal Revenue Service office and calculated her tax returns, and then took them home and then mailed them. And somehow the IRS lost that return out of every other return she ever filed. But in the 94 return, she calculated capital gain losses on her stocks. Upon being charged with failure to file the 94 return, the defendant went and filed a duplicate 1994 return, which was admitted into evidence, I believe, as Exhibit S-3. In that particular exhibit, the defendant, under penalty of perjury, asserted that the stock that she received in 1994 had a basis of 8 cents a share. The testimony and evidence admitted at trial was that the defendant sold the stock, by and large, to the 51 investors listed in the stipulation number 3, for somewhere between 50 cents to a dollar a share. Even taking the defendant's own math, anything over 8 cents a share would have resulted in a gain to her.
Was that presented to the jury, that argument, or that position?
That particular argument was not presented to the jury. It was in evidence for the jury. The jury was presented with the fact that the defendant, when refiling her return, claimed an 8 cents a share basis. And it was before the jury that she sold the stock to most of the investors at a dollar a share, and then as time went on, the price dropped to 50 cents and other prices per share. The evidence also was present in the record that the defendant sold stock she did not own and had no hope of owning. You see, the whole case really transpired because the defendant took the position that she was not compensated, she received stock as a gift. She was completely unaware that she was going to get a gift, but for months before she received this unknown gift that she didn't anticipate, she was selling stock that she had no reason to expect that she was going to get. Then she sold the stock. And then when she ran out of that stock, she continued to sell more stock that was not replaced for 2 or 3 years later. She had no basis under her theory to expect that there'd be a future receipt of 1 million shares of stock, which is what the evidence was, that she used to fulfill orders and sales and cash that she realized. By that alone, the defendant was engaging in a fraud. The parties in the court were aware. There was an effort made to keep the fraud out of the case. They were trying it just as a receipt and sale of the stock. She sold stock she did not own. She realized the cash, and she spent it. And what's telling here is that you're talking about an individual who at her best days made $20,000 a year working as a state employee. She leaves the state for retirement, receives somewhere in the nature of $3,000 or $4,000 of retirement income, and then starts selling $90,000, $60,000, $20,000. She starts selling, I believe, a total of $178,000 worth of stock in less than a 3-year period of time. I mean, it's an enormous amount of money. The fact that the jury was told to look at what the defendant said. The defendant said, I did not report the stock sales on my 1995 and 96 return because a volunteer, temporary H&R Block employee out of season went and prepared my returns for 95 and 96 and told me I didn't have to report these stock sales because I sold them at a loss, and I didn't have to report the stock sales until the certificates were discovered. The problem was that witness, Ann Westfall, actually testified, denied that that conversation never happened, that the defendant actually sold the preparer's stock, and when the preparer, before she prepared the 95 and 96 returns, gave a $500 check for stock to the defendant, she told the defendant, now you know, this is September 1997, you're going to have to report this on your 97 tax returns. Defendant wasn't surprised by that. Defendant didn't say, well, wait a second, I've got sales here, I've got sales in 95 and 96 that you're going to do. She doesn't tell her that. The preparer said, do you have any other income? The witness didn't tell her that. So I've lost my train of thought and I can't tell you where I'm going now. But
you're convinced there was sufficient evidence to show that the offense was committed.
It goes without saying. And the literal truth doctrine really doesn't apply here. The Reynolds case really talked about a defendant who technically correctly filled out a return, a 1040 EZ, which only asked for W-2 income, and the government was asserting that illegal conduct, which didn't result in W-2s, should have been reported on that form. The defendant, that form didn't call for it. Illegal income couldn't have been reported on the 1040 EZ, and this court held that, you know, the statement of the 1040 EZ was literally true because the information that the government sought to hold him accountable for wasn't called for on the return. So getting back to the simple salient facts is the jury, without even consideration of Mr. Welch, without even consideration of the stock sales, the jury was told, look, she's got gambling income she didn't report. The defense sole response to that at the time of closing argument was to basically tell the jury that, you know, there's a general lack of awareness that every time you pull the slot machine and win, that that's a taxable event. And, you know, isn't it kind of unfair that you could lose more than you win and still have a taxable event and get a W-2? Well, that doesn't answer the jury's question, and it doesn't answer the fact that the defendant had W-2Gs, which she stipulated to, which went into evidence. There was no question that she didn't get them. There was no question that they weren't included on her return, and her preparer asked her for it. She gave 50% of the income reported for 1 year, and she underreported by another almost half in the subsequent year. So, and when you dovetail back to her willfulness, remember, she told the tax preparer she was aware or understood the concept that sales had to be reported. She told the IRS agent that she knew she had to report stock sales in the year that she received them. When she went to a casino and filled out an application to lodge herself at the casino, she indicated that she had $80,000 of income from stock sales while being retired. That $80,000 roughly matched the amount of money for the 2 years that were charged for the false return. And then again, if you consider even her own assessment of what the value would be. I want to point out the summary evidence. The defendant stipulated to the evidence that went into the summary chart. The defendant agreed without objection to introducing the evidence on the summary chart. There was no real improper testimony by Mr. Welch. What happened was the defendant wanted this summary witness to help him further his theory. The defendant's theory was to keep this as far away from fraud as you can. We don't want a parade of local residents coming in here being defrauded. We want to cast this as, I got a gift. So she sought to elicit from the revenue agent who it was disclosed and it set forth in Appendix 1 that he was going to testify, among other things, to the unreported income of the defendant. The defendant sought to elicit from the special agent, the summary witness, that, you know, if the defendant received this stock, this 300,000 shares of stock in 1994 as a gift, for her to properly do this, she should probably know the capital gains laws. She should know what the donor basis was. And do you know what the donor basis was? The agent had the answer, no. Do you know what other aspects would have to be done? And the agent said, well, to properly calculate it, you have to know the gift tax that was paid by the donor if it was truly a gift. And if it was a gift, you'd have to know the fair market value on the date she received it. That's how we get to this problem here of the defendant eliciting, well, have you heard anything about fair market value? Well, the answer that the agent gave was, it was restricted stock. He thought it had no value.
I guess since it was stipulated, the agent was not asked where he came up with the $21,500 and $60,450 then as the income from the sale of the stock.
It was treated as the actual sales of the stock. He just tabulated what the investor said they gave the defendant, whether they hadn't gotten their stock and weren't going to get it, or whether they had actually got their stock. Defendant.
But that doesn't take into consideration any basis to apply that.
It didn't take into consider a basis, but it wouldn't have properly considered a basis for the fact that she didn't know she was going to have, had no reason to anticipate she was going to have. And that really makes sense, because in any penny stock case, if you were to allow an individual to sell stock and defraud investors and receive all the proceeds of that stock and just never deliver the stock, there'd never be a taxable event and the defendant would never have realized income. That's not right. When you try and push, as they have stretched, to get this into some kind of short sale, those are all sales which call for the delivery of goods at a specified date. This particular defendant promised to deliver stock within the examples we cited in our brief in 90 days or less, and that just didn't happen. In some cases, the two of the individuals, it was almost 2 years. One individual, it was almost 3 years. So it wasn't pursuant to a contract. You can't push this into some kind of short sale type of analysis. And the evidence is that this stock was, by and large, worthless. It wasn't argued to the jury because everyone agreed that that wasn't really being presented to the jury. It isn't as clear as it could be in the record, but it's clear enough from the sidebar with the judge, with Judge Scott. Now, if you look at the inherent nature of what this stock was that this individual was selling, it was worthless. And Agent Welch's evaluation of it is having no basis other than what the person could peddle it for and dump it on unsuspecting individuals was not clearly wrong. And it's not clearly wrong because when you look at the evidence, the company had 900 million shares of stock issued. The face value of the stock, the par value, was 0.0001. And that's before it even had a restriction. The defendant was peddling stock that was restricted. The individuals who were purchasing it, at least initially, didn't know it was restricted until they got their shares. And if they didn't get their shares for a year or more, they had no clue of that. The defendant testified, or defendant made statements to other individuals, the company had no income. She wasn't getting paid a salary. There was no payroll. And that was the fact from the time that she moved herself out to Las Vegas, moved herself back to Springfield. Over a three-year period of time, this company had nothing. The defendant did not want us to prove that which she now claims we should have proved, which is that there's alternative ways of evaluating this, the assets, the net worth. If that were to have been brought forward, it would have been palpably clear that which the defendant didn't want anyone to know, is that it was all a sham. The assets were illusory. The company was it was a penny stock fraud. She didn't want that. But if you look at just what's in the evidence, what the defendant admits to, no income. I believe in one of the letters to the investors, it's basically a calling card for fraud. They're owning casinos, they're Indian reservations, they're working on a cure for AIDS. They did virtually everything but nothing. And in all the period of time that they was there, if there's no income and they can't even make a payroll, there's no reason to believe that which she had any value. And what's also telling is that the defendant testified that she sold stock without having any idea what it was worth. It would be stunning to think that you would sell something without having any clue of what it was worth. But the defendant testified when she initially was selling the stock, she had no clue of what it was worth, but she was just selling it anyway. In conclusion, unless you have any other questions, the defendant has virtually forfeited and waived every claim that she could make because, in her theory, she wanted to keep this as it's a gift. Now, she wants to change it. It suited her theory to elicit the testimony that she now complains of. The evidence is more than sufficient to sustain the conviction, and I ask that you do. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. King. Ms. Johnson, you have 2 minutes.
The vast majority of the government's argument presented here today is that my client defrauded people, and therefore she should be, or her conviction in this case should be upheld. The problem here is that she wasn't charged with any kind of fraud, and the government didn't prove her guilty of the crimes with which they actually did charge her. And there's no evidence in the record that any kind of fraud occurred. The government claims that there's no evidence in the record because Pri attempted to keep it out. If you look at the record, the trial judge below actually denied that motion in part, and only granted it for Pri to the extent that the government agreed and accepted that it would keep out certain evidence. In this case, you can't get to line 22 being wrong without knowing that the lines above it are wrong and, when they're corrected, don't equal what was reported on line 22. Nothing in the government's argument corrected that problem. Plus, the jury was never instructed how to get to line 22. They weren't told that what was testified to as being Pri's income, which was actually simply the money she received in exchange for stock, wasn't actually income, and that they had to do a calculation of basis. Without that instruction, there's no way that we can be confident that the jury actually found Ms. Pri guilty of every element of this offense.
What about the gambling income?
On the gambling income, there's no evidence that Ms. Pri didn't give all of the W-2Gs that she had in her possession to the tax preparer. There's no evidence that Ms. Pri asked the tax preparer not to include all of her gambling income on the returns. There is simply no evidence of willfulness whatsoever with respect to Ms. Pri's gambling income. The government's mere conclusion that she reported some of it in one year and not in another is just not good enough to get to willfulness in the context of what actually happened in this case and what the tax preparer testified to. I'd like to address briefly the government's argument that the literal truth doctrine shouldn't apply here. It's not questioned that actual falsity is an element of this offense. That's not only in the Reynolds case, that's in the Peters case as well. And since the government failed to prove that, I would ask that you reverse Ms. Preece's conviction. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Johnson. Ms. Johnson.